Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell. Chapter 2, Laramie Fashions and Sioux Etiquette. The Laramie and Sioux Indians were in those days the lords of that portion of the plains over which we traveled during the first several weeks. They were fine specimens of physical manhood. Tall, erect, well-proportioned, they carried themselves with a distinct air of personal importance and dignity. They had not taken to the white man's mode of dress. Each had, in addition to his buckskin breeches and moccasins, a five-point Mackinaw blanket, these compromising for him a complete suit. The blanket he used as an outer garment when needed and for his cover at night. Many of the more important big Injuns owned also a buffalo robe. This was the whole hide of the buffalo with the hair on it, the inner side tanned to a soft, pliable leather, and the irregularities of its natural shape neatly cut away. It furnished the owner with an excellent storm robe, sufficient protection head to foot in the severest weather. The Indians of these tribes that we met were friendly, even to familiarity. One of them would approach an immigrant with a glad-to-meet-you air, extending a hand in what was intended to be white man fashion. But Mr. Lowe was a novice in the art of handshaking, and his awkwardness in mimicking attempts in the effort were as amusing to us as satisfactory apparently to him. His vocal greeting, with slight variation from time to time, was in such words with little regard for their meaning as he had caught from the ox-driving dialect of a passing immigrant. "Wohaw book! Hello, John, got tobacco?" If he added "gimme biscuit" and "papoose heap sick," he had about reached the limit of his English vocabulary. Large game was common along some parts of the way. Buffalo, elk, antelope, deer on the plains and hills, bear, mountain lions, wildcats, and other species in the mountainous sections. They were shy and not easy to take, but we captured a few of some varieties. Some members of the party demonstrated that fishing was good in the Rocky Mountain streams. Naturally, the men were hopeful of securing specimens of the larger game. But our lack of experience and scarcity of proper equipment for the purpose were against the chance, though not to the extent of our entire disappointment. Only persons of much experience on the plains could form even an approximate estimate of the great number of buffaloes sometimes seen together. It has been stated that there were herds numbering more than 50,000. Such an aggregation would consume days in passing a given point, and in case of a stampede, all other animals in its path were doomed to destruction. A herd of buffaloes, quietly grazing, was sometimes difficult to distinguish when viewed from a considerable distance, from a low forest, their rounded bodies and the neutral tint of their shaggy coats giving them the appearance of bushes. When the train was nearing the fork of the Platte River, a herd of buffaloes was seen, quietly grazing on the plain, a mile or more to the right, beyond a small watercourse. Deciding we would try our prowess, Captain Maxwell and this narrator rode to the creek. At a point some distance below the position of the herd, where we tied our horses, then crept along under cover of the creek bank until we had gone as near as possible without being seen by the herd. It's distant from us not much more than 100 yards. Cautiously peering above the edge of the bank, we selected a choice buffalo among those nearest us, and both fired. The entire herd galloped wildly away, continuing till all passed from view over a hill some miles northward. Not one showed sign of having been hit. As we were about to leave the place, what should we see but a lonely buffalo coming down the slope toward where we were, moving with a leisurely tread and manner perfectly unconcerned. Notwithstanding our recent firing, This animal evidently had no suspicion of our presence. We remained and awaited his coming. He walked a few steps, then browsed a little as if in no hurry about anything. Captain John and I felt our hope rise. We laid our plans and waited patiently. Just where the buffalo trail led down the bank to the creek, there were, as in many places near the stream, some scattered cottonwood and other trees. One of these that once stood on the brink had fallen till its top caught in the fork of another tree and rested at a gentle incline upward from where it had grown. At the roots of this fallen tree we concealed ourselves to wait, hoping that the big animal would come down to the water but a few yards from us, for we guessed that he was one that had not yet had his drink from the brook that day and was determined not to leave until he slaked his thirst. It was an anxious while of waiting, but not long. I was fearful that my hard, thumping heartbeats would be audible and frighten him away. Could it be true that I had an attack of buck ague? Perish the thought. Finally, his bovine majesty came lazily over the top of the bank, with a heavy, slow motion, grunting and puffing, as if he were almost too heavy for his legs. When he got to the bottom of the bank and was about to drink, Captain John whispered our agreed signal. 1, 2, 3. We fired simultaneously and repeated. The big fellow stood still for a moment after the shots and looked about, with a slow movement and stolid gaze, turned his head questioningly from side to side, as if he would say, "I thought I heard something pop." Somehow we knew we had hit him, and we wondered why he did not fall. His little black eyes rolled and glinted under his shaggy foretop. Then he seemed to swell, crouching slightly, as does a beast of prey when about to spring, lowered his head, pawed the earth, and shook his mane. His whole body became vibrant with the obvious desire to fight, and no antagonist in sight. Uttering a tremendous grunt, he arched his back again, stamping with all 4 feet, somewhat like the capers of a Mexican bronco when preparing to buck. Then he snorted once more with such explosive force as seemed to shake the tree beside which we were hidden, as he looked about for something to pitch into. By this time we thought we understood why a kind providence had caused that cottonwood tree to lodge at such an angle that a buffalo could not climb it. But we could, and we did. Getting ourselves safely into the fork of the tree, we continued to shoot from our quan of vantage till the big fellow dropped. When he ceased to kick or give any sign of belligerency, we came down and approached him carefully. Then we dressed him, or as much of him as we could carry, in 2 bags that we had strapped behind our saddles, and rejoined the train after our people had gone into camp for the night. We had our first buffalo steak for supper that night. We also had the satisfaction of observing signs of jealousy on the part of the other men who had never killed a buffalo. One of the first natural curiosities we saw was Chimney Rock, a vertical column of sandstone something like 40 feet high, with a rugged stone bluff rising abruptly near it. Its appearance from our distant view resembled a stone chimney from which the building had been burned away as it stood. Solitary on the flat earth at the south side of the Platte River, we traveling up the north shore, such a time-chiseled monument was a novelty to us then, and to the early immigrants it was the first notable landmark. While some distance farther west, as we scaled the higher slopes, we could see to the southward the snow-capped peaks of that region, which long afterward was taken from western Nebraska to become the territory of Colorado, and later still the state of that name. Looking over and past the locality where, more than a year thereafter, the town of Denver was laid out, we saw during several weeks the summit of Pike's Peak, hundreds of miles away. One evening, when we were going into camp, we were overtaken by a man trundling a pushcart. This vehicle had between its wheels a box containing the man's supplies of food and camp articles, with the blankets, which were in a roll, placed on top, all strapped down under an oilcloth cover. With this simple outfit pushed in front of him, this man was making his way from one of the eastern states to California, a distance of more than 3,000 miles. He was of medium-sized, athletic appearance, with a cheerful face. He visited us overnight. The next morning, he was invited to tie his cart behind one of our wagons and ride with us. He replied that he would be pleased to do so, but was anxious to make all possible speed, and felt that he could not wait on the progress of our train, which was somewhat slower than the pace he maintained. It was said that he was the first man who made the entire trip on foot and alone from coast to coast, as we were afterwards informed, he succeeded in doing. From time to time, the tedium was dispelled by varied incidents, many that were entertaining and instructive, some ludicrous, some pathetic, and others profoundly tragic. Agreeable happenings predominated largely during the early stages, and those involving difficulties and of grave import were mainly a part of our experience towards the close of the long pilgrimage. Such an order of events might be presumed as a natural sequence, as the route led first over territory not generally difficult to travel, but farther and farther from established civilization into rougher lands and toward those regions where outlawry common to all pioneer conditions was prevalent. With our company were four or five boys and young men, 18 to 21 years of age, also a kindly and unpretentious but droll young fellow named John C. Aston, whose age was about 25. This younger element was responsible for most of the occurrences of lighter vein, which became a feature of our daily progress. Aston's intimate friends called him Jack, and some of the more facetious shortened Jack Aston by dropping the ton, inconsiderately declaring that the briefer appellation fitted the man even better than did his coat, which was always loose about the shoulders and too long in the sleeves. But all knew Jack to be an excellent fellow. His principal fault, if it could be so termed, was a superabundance of good nature, a willingness at all times to joke and be joked. He had a fund of stories, in some of which he pictured himself the hero, with which he was wont to relieve the tedium of the evening hours. A violin was among his effects, which he played to accompany his singing of entertaining countryside songs. Most of these were melodious and highly descriptive. Jack had much music in his soul and sang with good effect. There was one melody that he sang oftenest, and sang from the heart, one that was rendered nightly, regardless of any variation in the program, a composition that embraced 17 verses, each followed by a soothing lullaby refrain, a song which, every time he sang it, carried Jack again to his old home in the sunny south, and seemed to give him surcease from all the ills of life. Of that song, a single verse is here reproduced, with deep regret that the other 16 are lost, with all except a small fraction of the tune. Yet cold, inanimate music notes on the paper would convey, to one who had never heard him sing them, only the skeleton. The life, sympathy, and soul of the song would be lacking. We needed no other soporific. Here it is. Oh, the days of bygone joys, they never will come back to me. When I was with the girls and boys, a-courting down in Tennessee. Ooh-lee-ay-lee-ay-loo-ee, courting down in Tennessee. It was Jack's habit to allow his head to hang to the left, due presumably to much practice in holding down the large end of his violin with his chin. He was prone to sleep a great deal, and even as he sat in the driver's seat of a prairie schooner or astride a mule, the attitude described often resulted in his being accused of napping while on duty. the climatic conditions peculiar to the plains, and the slow, steady movement of the conveyances were conducive to drowsiness, in consequence of which everybody was all the time sleepy. But Jack was born that way, and the very frequent evidences of it in his case led to a general understanding that whenever he was not in sight, he was hidden away somewhere, asleep. Jack's amiability, too, was a permanent condition. Apparently no one could make him angry or resentful. For this reason, he was the target for many pranks perpetrated by the boys, like this. One evening, Jack took his blanket and located for the night a spot apart from the others of the company under a convenient sagebrush. The next morning, he was overlooked until after breakfast. When the time came for hitching the teams, he was not at his post. A search finally revealed him still rolled in his bedding fast asleep. When several calls failed to arouse him, one of the boys tied an end of a rope around Jack's feet, hitched a pair of oxen to the other end, and hauled the delinquent out some distance on the sand. Jack sat up unconcernedly, rubbing his eyes, then began untying the rope that bound his feet, his only comment being, "Yuli Ili A Louis quarreling down in Tennessee." Join me next week for more Western Adventure in Crossing the Plains, Days of 57, by William Audley Maxwell, here on the Sagebrush Trail.